Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to the folks from Earthworks Institute. I'm very happy now to welcome Manisha Thakur. She is a personal finance expert for women and co-author of several books about financial literacy, including On My Own Two Feet and Get Financially Naked. And tomorrow, Wednesday, June 9th at 5:30 in the evening, HomeWise is hosting a lecture by Manisha. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here, Mary Charlotte.
So this is a kind of show that I rarely do here on the Radio Cafe, but I thought it was important because learning to control your own finances and some of the issues that come up for women in particular are important and probably not talked about enough in general. Tell us your own story of how you got interested in personal finance. I mean, you learned at home, which is something that most of us probably don't do.
You know, I grew up in a very unique family in the sense that my parents taught me about money early on, and my father in particular taught me about the power of compounding literally at the age of 11. I can still remember sitting at the kitchen table, and he worked in finance, and he sat me down with a financial calculator, and he showed me if I saved my babysitting and my lawn mowing money and it earned 8% a year, how to calculate how much money I'd have when I was in my 60s. And when I saw those numbers, I was hooked on the idea of saving. And so it really started very early with me, and it changed my life. And because I could see the power of how being financially responsible can give you so much freedom and choice as a woman, I want to share that with other women.
One of the things that I didn't know was that most men die married, most women die single. And for some part of every woman's life, or almost every woman's life, she is going to be providing for herself.
It's so true. You know, the statistic that's often quoted as 90% of women will spend some period of their adult life alone. And so we hear that a lot, and our eyes tend to glaze over. Yeah. I came across a stat a couple of years ago on the website for the Women's Institute for Secure Retirement, and I've never been able to find the underlying source data, but the stat stuck in my head. It said 80% of men die married, 80% of women die single. And it's not because we're killing the men off, it's because we live longer, and couples, when they divorce in midlife, men have a higher propensity to remarry, frequently to a younger woman, and that just propels the cycle. And so I don't know if the 80-80 number is exact, but ever since then I've been reading the obits, and it's amazing. It's got to be close to that.
And so for that reason, it is very important for women not to put their financial literacy into the hands of a man or anybody really but themselves.
I love to say a man is not a financial plan. And, you know, I learned somewhat the hard way in the sense that, you know, growing up, I was like your classic chubby, nerdy kid with braces and Coke bottle glasses. And it was just really clear to me from a very young age that a man was not going to be my ticket to anything. And then as I got older and I started to just hear story after story of women who had been shortchanged in their lives, had given so much to others only to end up, you know, two-thirds of women over 65 right now rely on meager Social Security payments as their primary source of income, which in plain English means they're literally choosing between medicine and food. And it doesn't need to be that way if you implement some basic financial principles in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and so forth.
What are some of the really common mistakes that women make with money?
You know, I think the biggest one is not starting to save early on because you believe it's just not that much money. And, you know, if you do something as simple as save $100 a month starting in your 20s, every month in your 20s, $100 a month, and you do that until you're in your 70s and your investments grow at 8%, you've got $500,000 from that $100 a month. If you wait until you're in your mid-40s, start saving, which is when most of us start thinking about it, that same $100 a month you save, you'll end up in your 70s with about $95,000. So you get five times more money by starting early on. And so that's really a key message that I'm trying to get out. The second one, though, is it's never too late. Even if you didn't start in your 20s, you can still get there.
There are also some kind of horror stories that you write about in your book of women who are young and in love or whatever, co-signing a loan with some dude, and then 10 years later, they're still paying off this other person's loan that they have nothing to do with anymore, things like that.
The stories I have heard, it's really painful. I mean, I think, and I say this as a bra-burning feminist, I mean, women, generally speaking, we tend to be very caring and we want to be helpful. And oftentimes, if we're with someone that we care a lot about and they're in financial distress, we'll offer to help out. And I cannot tell you the number of stories I've heard of individuals that have consolidated, for instance, student loans. And that's a type of debt that doesn't go away even in bankruptcy. But I've heard everything from mortgage payments to credit cards. And so my point is, get financially naked with each other. It's an awkward topic. But if you're going to take your clothes off with each other one way, you want to be able to talk about finances in an equally as intimate a manner.
There's a kind of awkwardness around that, because when do you do that? I mean, as you say in your book, it's not a conversation that you have on the first date, but it's definitely a conversation that you have sometime before you make a life commitment with somebody, whether it be getting married or moving in together or whatever.
You know, it's such a hard, I mean, that's the number one question that I get. Well, when am I supposed to do this? And, you know, it's kind of like trying to answer the question, well, just got married. How many kids should we have? It's highly personal. But in general, what I would say is, if you think this person is the one, then it's the time to start the conversation. And, you know, a little bit of financial foreplay, as I call it, is a great way to ease into the conversation, because it is profound. I call it the pink elephant in the bedroom. It is profoundly awkward to talk about money.
One thing I've noticed before reading your book also is that it's actually quite important for two people in a couple to be, what would you call it, have the same level of materialism. If one person is far more materialistic than the other, it leads to a lot of problems just from the get-go.
Yes, it's so true. And, you know, what's interesting is when you meet someone special, your friends will ask you, are you physically compatible or emotionally or spiritually compatible? But rarely do people ask you, are you financially compatible? But if one partner places a very heavy emphasis on material possessions, another partner places a very heavy emphasis on experiences, that's a recipe for friction. And it doesn't mean that the relationship can't work, but it does mean that you're going to have to talk it out. And it's a skill and an area of potential conflict in a relationship that we're not taught to identify or address head on.
We're talking to Manisha Thakur about personal finance and women. Now, credit card debt is a huge problem for a lot of people, and there are terrible abuses, which we've talked about at some length on this program, on the part of credit card companies, exploitive lending, predatory, dishonest, all kinds of lending. What do you advise people who have serious debt?
So if you have serious credit card debt, one of the beauties of America is if you have an idea, you can put it out to the marketplace. One of the downsides is some of those ideas aren't always so helpful. And right now I'm seeing so many ads for credit consolidation and debt repair. And honestly, it's like if you're overweight, which right now I feel like I am, the only way you can get yourself back into shape is to earn more or spend less. Just like if you're, you know, not financially fit, you need to exercise more and eat less. And when it comes to credit card debt, honestly, if you can double the minimum monthly payment that you are making on your credit cards, you will dramatically reduce the amount of time, the way the math works with compounding and interest rates. That simple step, it doesn't have to be anything more complex than that. Double the amount of the minimum monthly payment you're making. And that's a great first place to start. Or another way to think about it is, if you have $5,000 or less in credit card debt, if you can add just an extra $50 a month to your payments, you will have that debt paid off in 4 to 5 years, depending on the interest rate. And if it's over $5,000, add an extra $100 a month.
How do you advise people to keep from getting into trouble with credit cards in the first place, besides not having them, which is a perfectly good idea and a reasonable idea for a lot of people, but what are some of the scams and red flags to watch out for, and how should people really, you know, stay out of trouble?
You know, credit cards are this fascinating product because they can be your friend or your foe depending on how you use them. So if you use a credit card, I'll call it, quote, the right way, and I would define that as simply a tool for convenience to keep you from having to lug around wads of cash in your pocket, to help you build a good credit score, which will happen if you pay your bills on time at the end of each month. And then very importantly, just as a tool for cash flow management, if you pay that bill off in full when it comes. Or said slightly differently, if you charge something on your credit card and you only make the minimum monthly payment, basically what you just did is double the purchase price. So credit cards aren't bad. It's the way that we use credit cards that can be so bad. And so my advice is, first of all, don't have too many of them. I think there's never a reason to have more than three, a primary, a backup, and maybe one that you use for work expenses that are reimbursed to keep the accounting simple, and always pay the bill off in full. And if you can't afford to do that, then don't be charging that item to begin with.
Let's get back to the question of money and getting into a life partnership with somebody. What are some of the problems that come up that you've seen and that people have told you about when people talk to their partners or potential partners about money?
So the first problem is just that opposites really do attract. So, and academic studies have shown that we are kind of genetically or psychologically, if you will, predisposed to be attracted to our financial other. And I want to put that out there because a lot of people, when they are in a place of financial tension with their money, feel very alone. And I want people to understand that it's actually incredibly common. We just don't talk about it. And here's the reason why. You know, if you're a saver like me, I'm like the total tightwad, that, you know, going out with somebody who's like popcorn and a Coke at the movies, for $10, bring it on. There's something really intoxicating about that kind of wild behavior. And if you're a spender, being with someone like me who refills their, you know, Nalgene water bottle and refuses to buy $3 packaged water, can feel very comforting because there are boundaries. And then after a while, that newness wears off and you get to a point of tension. So really the biggest problem is just this general one where you both look at the world completely differently through financial lenses.
And I would think that in those conversations, there would be a real tendency for each side to try to make the other one more like them.
I say, Mary Charlotte, that's exactly what happens. And so, I mean, the answer isn't to try and to turn each of you into clones of the other, but really to understand how you can find some point of happy overlap. And oftentimes, I find what I call the financial three-way to be a very useful tool where you have, each person has some money of their own, and then there's joint money. And that you make joint decisions around the joint money, and if it's a couple where you're each earning your own money, you contribute to that joint fund proportionally to how much you earn, and what's left over is free for each of you to spend on discretionary items as you see fit. And there are other steps that you can take if some people feel very strongly that a marriage is a union and you must join accounts. And if that's okay, great. Set a dollar amount above which you agree to consult each other before spending. Set a dollar amount you're each allowed to spend each month, no questions asked. Simple steps like that can really make a big difference.
I find that when people talk about the various questions in society surrounding money, the world kind of divides into those who talk about personal responsibility, which you were talking about, and which is very important. I mean, personal, individual, financial responsibility, and all the choices that we make thoughtfully or thoughtlessly in the course of a day can add up to huge consequences. So there's that, which you talk about in your books. Then there's this whole other side of it, which is that we live in a country where there are millions of minimum wage jobs, and even Santa Fe has the so-called living wage, which if you're trying to live on that as a single person is almost impossible to make ends meet, much less save, much less pay debts. How do you look at the large, you know, you as somebody who's involved in this personal responsibility, at the larger issues in which people are being really pretty badly used by the system?
I worry about it a lot, and it's gotten worse because media images are so prolific, and that combined with easy access to credit is just this toxic recipe. And what I mean by that is, you know, we live in a country where daily we see images of, quote, average lifestyles that are anything but. I mean, a classic example would be turn on any of the police dramas. There is no one I know who is hardworking and works in the law enforcement field who has the time, let alone the money, to groom to the level that you see on those shows. And so we have these unrealistic images in our heads. So you take that combined with predatory practices that go on, encouraging people to borrow money that they can't afford to spend. The financial landscape has become so complex. And I really think the answer is we need this massive national wake-up call to sit down and figure out what really matters. I mean, we are drowning in stuff in this country, and there's such an imbalance. And from a micro level, I think that we can make some changes if everyone across the economic spectrum became more financially literate. I think people would start to feel gross in some areas about the kind of spending that was going on, and that might cause them, as titans of industry and so forth, to make different choices that would then improve the lives of everyone across the board.
I mean, the low-wage worker, you know, we talk about financial literacy. We also talk about nutrition and things like that, and a lot of people are working two full-time jobs in order to make ends meet. And the idea that you can then go to the farmer's market and make nutritious, healthy meals from scratch and all of that is just virtually impossible.
Right.
And the same thing happens with, you know, sitting down with a book and making all these lists of financial things, which is great and which is important to do. And I guess just the specter of gross inequality in this country, I can't help but think about it in relation to the work that you're doing and all the questions that it brings up.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we have seen is the gaps between the haves and the have-nots have never been wider in modern America. And I mean, if you take a look at the average executive's pay relative to the person who's enabling that executive to have the products and services that generate revenues to pay that pay, it's obscene. It's absolutely obscene. And I think part of the reason we got to this point, and I'm trying to say maybe not so articulately, is I think that there's a lack of financial literacy across the economic spectrum, even ironically, at the upper end. In other words, what I'm saying is I've met people who make $1 million a year who, believe it or not, are living paycheck to paycheck because they're spending more than they earn. And when you have that kind of excess everywhere, I mean, we've got to address it across the board to raise all boats.
You have an MBA from Harvard Business School, and that world, which I've seen not so close up, but knowing people who've been in that world and who come from that, it creates a kind of culture where, where you're encouraged to spend as much as you make. Is that true?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm like kind of the classic melting pot American. I grew up in a small town in Indiana, and nobody in my family had ever gone to a school like that. And I was educated in the public school system, and you know, my name's Manisha Thakur, and I grew up in southern Indiana, so as you can imagine, I felt like an outsider. And so, you know, I feel like when I was in business school, my perspective was very much one of an outsider. And so what I took from it was, wow, I mean, we live in this great country, and by some fluke of luck, I wasn't born in a village somewhere in a remote land where I didn't have sanitary conditions and was married off at age 12. And so I look at it as there's you can take the system, and there are many things wrong with it, but you can take the principles of business and you can use them for good. And the one silver lining out of this horrific economic mess is I think it's causing a lot of people who previously did not understand what it felt like to be an outsider and maybe rethink their values and their priorities. And that's what we need. We need a collective mental reset when it comes to all things financial.
Do you see that happening at the upper levels?
I do. I mean, would I like to see it happening faster and bigger? Absolutely. But I never thought I would see it happen in my lifetime, so I am encouraged.
What will you be talking about tomorrow at your presentation at HomeWise?
I'm going to focus pretty heavily on the investing component, because one of the things that concerns me a lot is if you've got a lot of money, there are plenty of people that are willing to give you advice on how to invest it. The problem is if you're working your tush off and you have a normal amount of money to invest, it's pretty darn hard to find somebody to give you competent investment advice. So I really want to help people figure out how to take those hard-earned dollars that they're able to tuck away and save and learn how to do what my dad taught me about with my babysitting and my lawn mowing money all those years ago, which is invest safely and wisely in a prudent mix of stocks and bonds using low-cost mutual funds, particularly index funds, and really trying to help give people the basic building blocks to make sure that they're maximizing the money that they are making.
Manisha Thakur is a personal finance expert for women. She's the co-author of several books about financial literacy, including On My Own Two Feet and Get Financially Naked. And once again, tomorrow at 5:30, she will be at HomeWise here in Santa Fe, which is on Siler Road next to Big Joe's Hardware. People should call to register, as seating will be limited. They can call HomeWise at 983-9473. Thank you so much, Manisha, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm delighted now to welcome back to the show Jan Willem Janssens, who is the executive director of Earthworks Institute, and Keena Murphy, who is conservation and stewardship director of Earthworks Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
It's so good to have you. We've talked over the years a number of times on this program about what you do, but I thought it'd be a nice day to really talk about the big picture of what Earthworks Institute has done. It started around 1994 with a permaculture school.
That's right. Yeah, I would say Santa Fe was blessed with a person that had moved just here in the community, Leslie Barkley, who came from the East Coast and had a long history in land conservation. She was one of the co-founders of the predecessor of Friends of the Earth, and was active in the National Land Trust movement. She also founded a conservancy, the Dutchess County Land Conservancy in upstate New York, and then came to Santa Fe, where she bought a beautiful property. But she soon discovered that land needed a lot of love, tenderness, and care, and that there was not a lot of knowledge around here on how to do that. And the knowledge that was around said, okay, do everything a little less. But she soon felt like, this land needs a lot more.
Meaning what? Restoration? It was damaged?
That's right. It was heavily overgrazed. It was eroding. There were ongoing floods in the Galisteo Creek because it was property with 2 miles of frontage on Galisteo Creek. And the grass didn't want to grow. So what do you do then? And so she felt like, well, we first need to think how people could live here. So, and that starts with the buildings. That starts with how people move across the landscape, paths and roads, capturing the water where it falls, making that water help plants to grow so that the roots grow the soil back. And just thinking about those things and studying with people like Ben Haggard, who was already very active in permaculture in those days here in town, and Joel Glansberg, and also people like Bill DeBuys and Michael Ogden, who was really in restored wetlands, constructed wetlands. She gathered a group of people like those who became early advisors for Earthworks Institute, and the word permaculture was dropped. And she really got onto that and felt like, that's what I want. And she also met Fizz Harwood, who was then, I think, not yet in Santa Fe, but also they were friends, and who also had an idea of a permaculture school that later became Ecoversity.
Right.
So there was this gestation of permaculture in the early 90s here in Santa Fe.
Now, what does permaculture actually mean? It's one of those words that you hear every third day or more often. What is it?
Okay, permaculture is a philosophy of land use that was introduced by Bill Mollison in the late 70s, early 80s, I believe, in Australia and Tasmania, where he looked at how different communities around the world have land use relationships or land relationships that make them successful in enduring their stay on the land while making the land more productive. And one of those techniques is, for instance, that you have permanent crops that are layered on top of each other that then allow different crops in different seasons and ecological relationships at different stages three-dimensionally on the landscape, from the higher canopy to lower canopy, on the ground and in the roots, that then basically build soil, build more vegetation, build a microclimate that more things can grow than you can ever believe if you just see the land.
So if you think about a cornfield planted in perfect rows and then a carrot field with perfect rows of carrots, this is not that.
It's exactly the opposite. Yeah.
So you've got all these things growing in among each other, and some are providing shade for the lower ones, things
that's,
like that.
That's right. Yeah. So they're all beneficial to each other, and it is a whole systems approach to growing.
So that it also extends beyond just crop growing, permaculture as a concept.
Oh, absolutely, because it's tied into the living and habitat of humans. So it requires human presence. So for the maintenance and the use of whatever comes out of the land, of course. So therefore, it's connected to how you build a home, how that home is actually grown out of the land, that you use local materials for that, that it is sited accordingly, so that you use natural energy, that water is being harvested and guided back onto the land for the irrigation of your crops, and so on.
And so these are things that many people in New Mexico are learning or trying to learn, and that seem like big, huge concepts. Of course, if you started a school, then kids are learning this stuff at an early age, and it becomes second nature to them.
Exactly. So from very early on, Earthworks Institute reached out to local schools to bring these ideas of permaculture to the schools and bring the schools out to the demonstration ranch that Earthworks used to have along the Galisteo Creek that was the Barkley and Earthworks Ranch. Yeah.
So then there was and is the Galisteo Watershed Restoration Project.
Ah, well, after the permaculture phase of Earthworks, the Earthworks team realized that they needed to evaluate what they were doing and how successful they were. So in 1996-97, they invited people from the entire conservation community, including Los Alamos National Laboratories, to come and look at what they were doing at the Earthworks Ranch, and how certain persistent problems of flooding and erosion could be tackled. And also UNM students participated in that and gave some clues about how to look at the wider landscape and how the bigger landscape influences what happens at the ranch and vice versa. So the concept grew that the ranch needed to look more at a watershed scale, because at a watershed scale, issues of how water flows, how wildlife migrates, how soil is being built, can be addressed. And out of that grew the idea of embedding the ideas of permaculture in a watershed concept. And the other component of that was really that Earthworks was initially really in need of reaching the communities. And by embracing a watershed approach, it was more able to look at these permaculture techniques in terms of the needs of the surrounding communities and residents. Which, if the activities just continued at the Earthworks Ranch, it would be too selfish. So it was important to get the information out, and a watershed scale approach really helped with that.
And of course, it's important for everybody living in a natural landscape to understand what a watershed is, where their water comes from.
Absolutely. And just right in the center of the Galisteo Basin, it was a major problem. Like, until probably today, even despite the rain we've had, there are households that have limited water, and where they know that the well may go dry if we have a dry summer, for instance, even this year.
So how do you go about restoring a watershed, both in terms of what needs to be done, but also getting people on board and the many different people who are necessary to help actually do something like that?
Well, we started actually in 98 by having community meetings, by just going to the different communities and asking, what do you like about this landscape? Why do you live here? How is your relationship to the land? And what do you grow? Why are you here despite all the difficulties of erosion, water shortages, long ways driving to town? And we got a sense of why people were there and could gradually appreciate what issues they had that earthworks could maybe respond to. And we had initially these big top-down ideas of academic ideas. You need to start at the top of the watershed and work your way down. But we felt like, no, we need to go with the flow, where there is a need, where you can mobilize a demonstration project and get a group of people enthusiastic in a way of restoring the land and how they connect then later through that restored land to other projects in the landscape.
And so what happened next?
Well, we created several restoration communities, you could say, in Cañoncito, which is just east of the El Dorado Wilderness, in the village of Galisteo, and along County Road 55A, which is a stretch of county road extending 5 to 7 miles east of Cerrillos. And later that was expanded to include the communities of San Marcos and the communities of Cañada Los Alamos, Valencia, Glorieta, later El Dorado as a larger community. So we've gradually touched upon many of the settled communities in the Galisteo watershed, and later also some of the ranches.
But so then you have all these community meetings and you talk to people and all this. What is the actual work of restoring a watershed so that there is sufficient water for everybody, both the animals and the plants and the humans living there?
Ooh, that is a huge task. And for us, that meant, first of all, making the water infiltrate where it falls, and with that, restoring the soil and growing plants and working with small areas where you show how it can gradually expand from there. And that is basically what our logo was, creating concentric circles of expanding ripples through the community.
So the water infiltrating where it falls... why hasn't it done that in the past? I mean, paved over or overgrazed or?
Well, yeah, the land has been severely overgrazed. There are there aren't as many native wildlife species on the land as there were before. So, sort of general ecosystem resiliency goes down. Then the land is less able to hold nutrients. It's less able to grow grass, and then it's less able to hold soil. And then you get massive erosion, you get down cuts and head cutting, which then lowers...
What's down cuts and head cutting?
Well, it's when you're looking at a river, and instead of the river being kind of like on the same level as, you know, the ground where you walk, it's pretty deeply cut down into a canyon or something like that. So that would be like down cutting. And so what happens with that is as the river down cuts, so the water table falls as well. So all the plants are not getting water the way that they used to. And so a lot of what we do is we build structures that help to cause aggradation, which brings that aggradation brings the sediment back, basically. And so instead of degrading, it's aggrading. It's coming back up. So, and so is the water table.
So, in other words, when there's more sediment in the river, the actual level of the river rises.
Well, yeah. I mean, basically. So, I mean, sometimes sediment can clog drainages and things like that, and it's not good. But, like in the case of the Galisteo, actually sedimentation is good. It's the thing that keeps the river from actually downcutting and going deeper and deeper into the earth, as I was explaining before. So... So it keeps the water on the surface, basically, or it helps to.
What is the role of native animal species in keeping watersheds viable?
Well, I think, you know, that's the sort of basic premise of it's why everybody is promoting biodiversity, is that the more biodiversity that there is, the more ecosystem resilience there is. And, you know, every... One thing that large ungulates do is add nutrients to our environment. I mean, so do a whole host of other small mammals. They just add.
What are some examples of large ungulates?
Oh, I'm sorry, are you an ecologist? That would be like large-hoofed animals, like deer and elk. Yeah. So, but really, all of our large mammals add tremendous amounts of nutrients into our environment, which helps the grass grow. ungulates or grazers, you know, eat grass and they stimulate the regrowth of grass, actually. You
if,
know, so
if it's not overgrazed.
If it's not overgrazed, yeah. Right. So it's all about striking that balance. And actually, our native species are what help us to strike that balance. If you just sort of throw a bunch of cows or goats or something out there on the land, you know, they're not adapted to this environment. They maybe eat everything down to nothing, which is, you know, unlike some of the other native species that are just more beneficial to the environment in general.
I think it's such an important point to make that when you're looking at a watershed, that biodiversity is part of it. And the reason people are fighting so hard for a diversity of animal species and for protection of endangered species and so on is not just because they have a right to life or because they're cute mm-hmm. or whatever, but because they're part of a system which we are also part of that keeps right. us alive.
Yeah, which we depend on, and we absolutely can't survive without it. You know, I mean, even something as simple as, you know, a bunch of birds hanging out in a meadow or eating seeds, they're spreading those seeds, they're planting them, you know, throughout a large range. You know, trees growing by rivers, you know, in a riparian area are filtering sediment, making sure that our rivers and lakes don't just fill up with sediment so that the water is actually usable to us. Wetlands actually hold water in place and recharge our groundwater, you know, just things like that. And one of the big things we do is work, we do a lot of wetland restoration. And wetlands are tremendously important in environments like this, in arid environments like this, because they do recharge groundwater and they do filter the water, the little bit of water that is there. And so, like, a lot of people are complaining about beavers. Well, beavers create wetlands and they create ponds and they hold the water back. A lot of people think, oh, well, beavers are stealing my water for farming and this and that. But really what is happening is they're making sure that your well water gets recharged every year, you know, because they're recharging the groundwater that you use. So
when, for example, Jan Willem, when a situation like that comes up, people say beavers are taking my water. How do you make them understand? How do you do that process of education where the population on that land understands the importance of that species or some particular species?
Yeah, we go back to the goal of why people even live there, to figure out what it is that people want from living there and what the values and amenities are that then maybe the landscape can provide. So then they need to balance out what they need to artificially bring in and what maybe nature can provide. And then gradually in the last 10 years, not so much us, but worldwide or in this country, more and more data has been collected to actually value in a dollar amount what the, you could say, ecological service in terms of dollars provides to living in a certain place in terms of water purification, flood control, water availability, the strength of the landscape so that you don't have to do erosion mitigation all the time.
Now, these are things that are called, and I think we discussed this term the last time that you two were here, ecosystem services. I think that's a term that hasn't quite made it into the everybody's general vocabulary, but basically, you know, the city provides sewage services. So does the ecosystem without our paying for it. All we have to do is protect it, basically.
Right. And actually here in Santa Fe, we have one of the first, maybe the first ecosystem, very simple ecosystem services project right here in our backyard. And that is the upper watershed, where the city and the Forest Service have come to an agreement on how that upper watershed needs to be managed so that it doesn't burn up, that the chances for fire are limited, and that it absorbs that water in an optimal way so that that flows into the reservoirs that provides drinking water to Santa Fe so that we're not as dependent on wells in the Rio Grande.
We're talking to Jan Willem Janssens and Kina Murphy from Earthworks Institute, which is located right here in Santa Fe. So let's talk about some of the projects that you're doing now. Everything you're doing now is connected to the type of concepts that we've been talking about.
Let's see, we have so many projects, it's hard to know where to start. But we have a series of river ecosystem restoration initiatives that we're working on, and that funding comes from the New Mexico Environment Department. And basically, we're working on a series of river restoration projects from all the way from Embuto, which Dixon area, to the Galisteo watershed. And those, what we do with those projects is we come up with a design that basically to restore a part of the river, and knowing that, you know, that's not going to solve the problem, what we do is we then engage the community that lives around there, and try to create community stewardship groups. And so we ask the community to come out, help us do restoration, do plantings, remove invasive species, do cleanup. We do a series of educational days. Education is usually surrounded around the monitoring that we do, where people get to know all of the different native species. And then we have workshops. We actually have restoration workshops, one of which we're doing June 19th in El Dorado with Craig Sponholt. So we're going to have a restoration workshop there as well. So we do a series of those events around our restoration projects. We have a series of wetland restoration projects that we're doing as well, and that's through a contract with NMED, and it's funded through the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. Yeah, I can't get that. And so those are going on also in the Galisteo Basin and in Santa Fe County in the sort of upper part of the Santa Fe watershed.
And all of these things are things that our listeners, wherever they might be in Santa Fe or Albuquerque or Taos or anywhere around here, can become part of if they want to.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about wildlife corridors, which is not a wolf walking down the hall.
No, it's not. And this is really what gets everyone excited. There's been a growing movement in the United States to basically create wildlife corridors because, as we know, you know, wildlife don't exist in sort of a box in just one limited little area. They need to migrate and move around and travel.
Unlike us, they don't move into a house and stay there.
Right, exactly.
They spend their summers in one place and their winters in another place.
Yeah, to a large degree, and a lot of animals are following their prey that are migrating and things like that. So we are working with, we're one of the founding members of a group called New Mexico Wildways, which is also a partner organization of the Wildlands Network, which is also part of the spine of the continent. And so this is a big international movement, basically, that New Mexico Wildways is tying into. And what we want to do, what we're working on in the Galisteo Basin is basically creating a whole wildlife initiative for the Galisteo Basin, where we will work on policy issues, trying to just open up corridors, making sure certain kinds of development doesn't happen within corridors. It also has to do with doing a lot of science, you know, just monitoring wildlife movement and assemblage patterns, because there's a huge gap in people's knowledge about how wildlife actually move and why they assemble the way that they do, and how community ecology actually works between different species. And then there's a mapping initiative that goes along with that. But along with all of our projects, we have a wildlife component that we work on. So as we do like vegetation monitoring, trying to see if our restoration is actually working, we're also implementing a wildlife monitoring program as well to just see what species are there, what habitats there, what they need, what's lacking, things like that. And then also, you know, to tie that back into ecosystem services, I'm working on a study that will really start to look at how basically large ungulates, those hoofed mammals,
our deer and mooses and elks and all those
things. Yeah, are affecting net primary production, meaning like the growth of plants within corridors that they're using, and then ultimately carbon sequestration. So as we're more and more concerned with global warming, it becomes really important for us to really figure out, okay, well, if we don't have our deer populations, we don't have our elk populations, are we really causing a detriment to ourselves and creating more global warming and things like that? Are they, you know, because are they adding a lot of nutrients to the environment and then causing more plants to grow, which are sequestering more carbon, you know, and making our general environment less hot? It's a simple way of putting it, yeah.
We're talking about the Earthworks Institute's many projects. Jan Willem Janssens, you have for a long time understood the importance of doing grassroots work, in other words, really engaging the community, as opposed to trying to get some government fix for things.
Yeah, I came here actually with a history of work in Africa, and when I saw the New Mexican landscape, I realized that we need to have a collaborative, multi-party approach to making the landscape more productive and healthy for everybody who's living here and going to live here. And I came at the heydays when there was a lot of people moving into New Mexico, and I think in the time that I've been here for the last 17 years, the population has grown with 400,000 or 500,000 or more. So, and I'm one of those.
Yeah.
So it is, it became clear to me that it was very important to look at how you can leverage people's knowledge, people's resources to take care of the land, because government agencies typically don't have a lot of money for ongoing stewardship and care. And as land is a living creature, like an animal, like ourselves, it needs ongoing care. And I thought back about farming. In Europe, a lot of the natural, where I'm from, a lot of the natural pockets that are still there, like hedgerows or even wetlands, are there as a result of, say, hunting, or certain forms of farming, or certain forms of peat digging. And as a result of these very functional economic livelihood activities, nature gradually developed, you could say. And I think gradually people respected that, and they started to realize that you can increase biodiversity by manipulating the land in a certain way. That it was it's very clear in Africa, too. And Tina can testify to that, too, I'm sure. That there is a way of interacting with nature that is both good for the local economy and people's livelihoods, and for the long-term stability of the land that nurtures the communities. But you have to start to understand what that relationship is. And I knew just a little bit about it, and I knew that if you start really engaging people, that you can collectively learn a lot and build bridges between somewhat sterile government programs that help do these things without really understanding what the full mechanisms are on the ground to do it. And so by bringing a lot of people together in these community groups, later community stewardship teams, later in larger groups like the Galisteo Watershed Partnership, or now the New Mexico Wildways, we're trying to explore what that means and trying to grow learning communities that engage with the land. And anywhere from schools, we start with that in the schools all the way to the community stewardship teams.
I think like the sort of new message here is really, I think what conservation professionals have done in the past is sort of assume that nobody knows anything about the land or wildlife.
Yeah.
And I really think that the difference here is, and what we're trying to do is to really provide a space for people to talk about, to share their knowledge of wildlife and the ecosystem and how they've lived in it and what works for them. And so if we all come together and we share our knowledge, then we'll come up with a good answer. We'll come up with a better answer, because I really feel that we're all, I mean, you know, there may be some people that have grown up in cities and are really disconnected from nature, but you know, kind of in Santa Fe and places like this, people are very connected to nature, and it's really important to listen to them and to figure out what they know and to incorporate that knowledge into what we do.
Kena Murphy and Jan Willem Janssens are with Earthworks Institute. They can be found on the web at earthworksinstitute.org. And the telephone number is
982-9806.
Thank you so much for being with us. And you can call Earthworks, or you can look at their website to find out how to get involved in the many great activities that are going on over there. It's great to have you on the radio.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.